Right. Good morning, everyone. I think I've got the recording started. So I will go ahead and kick us off so we have time to get through our articles today. So the first article that I'm going to discuss, Ying Chun, my colleague here at Mayor Rochester, is the lead author of this article. And Aisha was one of our former fellows. She was the first author. And it's an entitled Nuclear Protein in Testis or Nut Carcinoma. A comprehensive immunohistochemical study of 57 cases with consideration of interpretation and pitfall recognition. So, as you all are familiar with, nut carcinoma is very aggressive and associated with NUT M1 gene rearrangements. And it was initially described as a quote unquote midline carcinoma because it's high occurrence in the midline structures, including head and neck, mediastinum. But it's since been identified at quite diverse locations, although it definitely has a propensity for the midline. And it can be classic cases are more straightforward, but it does pose a significant diagnostic challenge because the morphology can be really variable. And especially on a small biopsy, it can be really hard because it can look just like a small round blue cell neoplasm, essentially, and can have overlap with other things that we see much more commonly, like small cell carcinoma, lymphoma, squamous carcinomas, SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated tumor. All of these things come into the differential diagnosis. So their aim was really to do a comprehensive IHC profile of a large cohort and identify diagnostic pitfalls. So they included 57 cases of nut carcinoma that were seen here at Mayo Rochester between 2012 and 2022. So 14 out of the 57 were consult cases. And all cases were confirmed either via positive NUT immunostain, which was true in 43 of the cases, NUT M1 gene rearrangement by FISH, which was done in 3 cases, or both FISH and IHC, which was done in 11. So they did include all anatomical sites, but two-thirds of them were thoracic slash mediastinal. So that was the most common primary location in this cohort. 23% were head and neck, which was the second most common, and then the other locations made up the rest of the cases. So they did a kind of a comprehensive immunohistochemical panel. Some cases had more stains done than others, but they all included keratin, various squamous markers, and neuroendocrine markers. So here in table one, you can see their demographics. So the mean age was 46, but they did have a really wide age range from age 2 to 83. So I think just again reinforcing the old concept that this occurred in young patients is not always true. There was no sex predilection. And I think this figure kind of nicely highlights the, let me just see if I can enlarge that a little for you guys. Morphologic difficulties, where an A is kind of a more class, oops, sorry, where A is a more classical looking case, and B is just these sheets of kind of primitive looking small round blue cells, where the diagnosis would be much more challenging. The classic morphology depends on this kind of abrupt keratinization in the background of more basaloid or primitive appearing squamous cells. So, as far as their cohort goes, the fusion partner was known in 3 cases and with NUT M1. So, 2 of them had MXD4 and 1 had BRD4 fusions. So, the IHC findings are really the crux of this paper. So, they have a table for each of the different key IHC groups, I would say. So, here is the table on keratin expression. So you'll note that they were variably positive with all sorts of different pan-keratins, but the kind of workhorse pan-keratin stains AE13, CAM5.2, and OSCAR showed positivity in 76 to 88% of cases. So CAM was actually the most sensitive, followed by AE13 and then OSCAR, which is kind of interesting because I always think of OSCAR as a very sensitive pan-keratin marker. And of note, of course, is that 15% were entirely negative for keratins, which present a diagnostic challenge, and even a little higher here in the thoracic cavity, where almost 20% were negative for keratin. And then here's a figure that just kind of shows the variability in keratin expression from nice and strong to more patchy to very focal and then to completely negative. All right, so here is the squamous marker table 3. So They noted that P40, as has been noted by others, is lower in sensitivity compared to other squamous markers. So, in particular, P63 was positive in 87%. Desmoglein 3, which is a squamous marker that we have here in Rochester, was positive actually in 100%, although the number of cases stained was only 11. And then P40 in comparison was only positive in about two-thirds of cases, so a bit less sensitive than other squamous markers that might be used. And again, here I thought was an interesting example of one case of nuc carcinoma, which shows this really nice strong and diffuse DSG3, really strong and diffuse P63, some patchy CK56, and then only focal P40 expression, as you can see here in D. And then table four is our neuroendocrine marker expression. Again, I think it's important to be aware of this. I think we've discussed recently that you can have neuroendocrine marker expression in thoracic SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated tumor. And this study, I think, also nicely illustrates that you can have neuroendocrine marker expression in nuc carcinoma as well. So focal expression of neuroendocrine markers, including SNAP-defysin, was seen in 18%, and CD56 was seen in 18%. Of note, two cases did show diffuse strong CD56. Chromogranin was negative in all cases. And then INSM1 was actually positive in over half. So 54% of cases were positive for INSM1, which potentially, obviously, could be a diagnostic pitfall. So, in all, any neuroendocrine marker in the thorax, a third of cases were positive for at least one neuroendocrine marker. And then here is their panel of staining. So you can see INSM1 here showing some patchy expression with just rare cells showing SNAP-defysin and negative. This particular example was negative for chromogranin and CD56. Table five here just goes over some other markers that were expressed at kind of lower frequency. Of note, in the thorax, you will see TTF1 expression in nuc carcinoma in up to nearly a third of cases. It was noted to usually just be weak and focal, but you can occasionally see staining for that. And they noted no difference between the SPT24 and the 8G, 7 clones in TTF1. And then occasional rare expression of other markers that could potentially, again, be diagnostic pitfalls. I think just highlighting how important it is to do a panel when you're dealing with something, some poorly differentiated tumor in this kind of category, because they did see, for example, some cases with focal Desmin, some cases with focal S100, CD99, SAL4. So again, just re-emphasizing that a panel is probably going to be needed to reach a confident diagnosis. So their kind of discussion, obviously nuc carcinoma does display a wide immunohistochemical spectrum in addition to that variable morphology that we talked about, which can really complicate diagnosis and make it more difficult. Keratin stains are variably positive and can be negative. I think it is interesting to think about those keratin negative cases and how those might dovetail with what has been described as nut rearranged sarcomas. And where the line will end up being drawn between those two different entities. And I will draw your attention to an article that I included here for just in the notation category, which is a nice paper on nut M1 rearranged sarcomas, a few of which were in the chest. So I included it just kind of for comparison, a nice kind of comparison for this. So I think there is still some ambiguity where we draw the line. The cases that were included as keratin negative in this series were done so because they had epithelioid morphology. But in most sarcomas have a more primitive or spindly morphology. So, but I think there's still some room for figuring out that particular niche of these tumors. Other kind of take homes besides the fact that keratin can be negative, your squamous markers P63 and desmoglein 3 seem more sensitive than P40. You can have neuroendocrine marker expression, which can lead to confusion if you don't think about nuc carcinoma and the differential and do your nut immunostain. And I think those were kind of the key take-home messages. I think this study does a nice job of highlighting the complexity of diagnosing nut carcinoma. It's a nice big cohort. The limitations include the low number of some of the immunostains that were done, as well as the lack of molecular testing on all cases to understand the fusion partners that were present. But this study was really meant to focus on IHC, which I think it did a good job of highlighting for us. Any questions, comments on that paper?
Hey, Jen, just a quick question. I mean, separating NACC carcinoma from NACC M1 rearranged sarcoma is difficult, but if you do the gene arrangement molecular study, you can separate these two apart, right?
Kind of. I think the sarcomas are have been described as having different fusion partners, but I think honestly, I don't think we know how much overlap there might be in fusion partners between the two groups or how they will be defined. I mean, I can imagine a setting in which the tumors will be defined by their exact fusion, but I think we have a ways to go in the data, the molecular data of these tumors before we can say, oh, this has this fusion, so this falls neatly into this category or that one. Any other questions or thoughts on this one? If not, I can move on. All right. So this, I couldn't help myself but to include this article entitled "Pembrolizumab plus Chemotherapy for Metastatic Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer with Programmed Cell Death Ligand 1 Tumor Proportion Score Less than 1%, Pooled Analysis of Outcomes After 5 Years of Follow-Up." So this is from Journal of Thoracic Oncology, and I think goes nicely highlights something that I've been thinking about recently, which is that there is pretty good data that patients with PD-L1 scores of less than 1% do have a better response to pembro plus chemo than they do to chemotherapy alone. But this article references some data from treating oncologists and pulmonologists that indicate in Europe, 62.4% of patients with PD-L1 scores of less than one are still receiving chemo alone as first-line therapy for their metastatic non-small cell carcinoma. And in the U.S., it's at least a third of patients that are still getting chemotherapy alone for first-line therapy for their metastatic non-small cell carcinoma. So the goal of this study was to basically use a pooled analysis of existing clinical trial data to specifically look at those patients, the long-term outcomes, so 5 year plus outcomes of patients with metastatic non-small cell carcinoma who had a PD-L1 less than one, who have been treated with pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy. So let me back up here a little too extreme close up there. All right, so what they did is they pooled analysis from four phase three clinical trials. That includes the Keynote, which includes the global Keynote 189, plus there was an extension in Japan, and both of those were included, and the Keynote 407, which included the global cohort as well as a Chinese extension that was added. So these patients had previously untreated metastatic non-small cell carcinoma. So one of the studies included non-squamous non-small cell carcinoma and the other included squamous. So we should have a good variety of a non-small cell carcinoma patients. And they were randomized to either receive pembrolizumab plus chemo or placebo plus chemo. So a true, clinical trial. And the patients and the investigators were all blinded to the PD-L1 results. Went before the trial started. The PD-L1 was testing was done using clone 223C, and the clinical endpoints included overall survival, progression-free survival, and treatment-related adverse outcomes. So they looked at 442 patients. So 255 received pembrolizumab plus chemo. 187 received placebo plus chemo, and the median follow-up was 60.7 months, so about 5 years. So I think we've got some. So here's the crux of it. So overall survival for pembro plus chemo was superior. It was 18.3 months was the median overall survival compared to 11.4 months in the cohort of chemo plus placebo. And progression-free survival also was superior in the pembro plus chemo category, although it's barely, but they are seeing a month different in median progression-free survival. So the overall 5-year survival rates for pembro plus chemo was 12.5% versus 9.3% for chemo alone. And again, with a cohort of this size, they were able to establish that that is a significant benefit of pembrolizumab as first-line therapy, even for patients that do not have a high or even intermediate TPS score. So as far as adverse events go, they were also similar. So grade 3 to 5 treatment-related, so more severe treatment-related adverse outcomes were seen in 59.1% of the patients that had pembro plus chemo and 61.3% in chemo plus placebo. So very similar rates of adverse events. So their conclusion is that the combination of pembro and chemo offers significant long-term survival benefits compared to chemo alone in patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer with a PD-L1 TPS score less than 1%. There are high rates of adverse events, but the rate is similar to those under receiving chemotherapy alone. And it's got durable efficacy that supports it as standard first-line treatment in this patient population. So I don't know if this means that we won't be doing PD-L1s forever or if they're still going to continue to want it as additional data point. But it looks like at this point, they're definitely moving towards treating all patients first line chemo plus pembrolizumab. Any comments or questions about that one?
I think it'll be interesting to see whether this data will be correlating with the small cell carcinoma subgroups. Maybe certain subgroups will even see more response to immunotherapy.
Yeah. Yeah, we haven't seen a lot of, we don't see a lot of PD-L1s for neuroendocrine carcinomas, but we do see a few coming through every time. I don't think we've seen a noticeable decrease in volume in our PD-L1s since this data has come out. I think it seems like our oncologists, at least for now, still want the data point, whether or not they're going to use it. But I don't know if anybody else has seen any differences in practice habits.
Yeah, no, we haven't seen any differences, but I mean, it seems like we should probably stop doing it if it doesn't make any difference. And I feel like this sort of confirmed anecdotally what we've kind of been seeing. It's like it may not matter.
Yeah.
So, gotta follow the data.
I feel like it's similar to those like HER2 super low, like ultra low in breast. So that they kind of want to push those treatments to like lower and lower expressions to the for the drug company. They will be able to have more indications to like all populations if they show some difference. But if in general the higher expression relate to better outcomes in general, but just not exclusive. But I think the clinician probably still want those, so they have a better idea of how likely the patient will respond.
I wonder if it will turn into like a prognostic differentiator. You know, people might do a little better with less than 1%, but then do significantly better if they have intermediate or high expression.
Yeah, and I think that was established like in the first trials, but if they're all going to be getting the drug, and I guess one PD-L1 immunostain probably isn't going to break the bank in the overall treatment course of the patients, but there's thousands of them being done every day, so I don't know if the cost benefit ratio is worth it or not.
I saw there's some study saying that the YAP1 subgroup of small cell carcinoma respond better to immunotherapy. So I'm thinking just probably more study need to be done whether only a subset of small cell really responds to immunotherapy, not all of them.
can envision a day where all patients get pembro or immune checkpoint inhibitor with their chemotherapy to see if they can tolerate it up front, but.
Then just ground zero whenever after, I mean, at first when it came out, I just couldn't help thinking, the responder cells are, even if it could be recruited from the blood, the local TILs, the tumor infiltrating cells probably play a role. And it may be a, I mean, I guess it's not our job, but looking at those who really do not respond, instead of who did respond, because immunotherapy is not without side effect and it's very pricey treatment, So I was wondering which one really didn't respond, maybe
Yeah.
something we
Yeah,
can,
somebody will design an AI algorithm someday, right?
yeah,
To
something
look
like
at
that.
tumor infiltrating lymphocytes and tumor stroma. There's actually another paper in the annotation section of this journal club, or for notation that does include basically that the tumor stroma, the degree of tumor stroma, also predicts response to immune checkpoint
Yeah,
inhibitors. So
something,
it's very
yeah.
complicated. I think the immune microenvironment of the tumor seems to be really important, although I think, we always struggle to understand
Yeah.
that. All right, and then there's a comment from Jeff here as well, who his camera and microphone is not helping him this morning, but he said Dr. Gajil was previously on faculty here and was repeatedly incredulous that a specimen read as greater than or equal to one in one lab could be read as less than one in another. And this is his response: treat them all. And I completely agree with that. I think the most important cutoff shouldn't be the most difficult one. And for me, like less than one or one is the most difficult portion. I mean, that's what, if I'm going to spend some time on a PD-L1 stain, it's because I'm agonizing over that decision. Like, do I really think that it's zero or less than 1%? Or are those all macrophages and inflammatory cells staining? Or do I really think there's scattered tumor cells that stain? So yeah, I think it's unfortunate that that cutoff it seems to be the most difficult and probably unreliable in our interpretation, but carries the most weight clinically. All right, very good. So move on to the next article. And this one, I mean, I don't think we need to belabor the data in this one too much, but I thought it was interesting to kind of for us to be aware of what's coming with the new ninth system or ninth edition of the TNM staging system for staging of lung cancer. So this study was done at the Asan Medical Center in Seoul, and has ba is basically a validation of what has been proposed by the IASLC as the new end stage criteria for in preparation for the ninth edition. As we all know, accurate lymph node staging is really critical in lung cancer. I often tell my fellows it's so important to get the lymph nodes right because stage is so critically important for prognosis in lung cancer and for therapy, what's going to happen to that patient next. So if you're going to, not mess up one thing, it's your lymph node status in your lung cancer cases. So the end descriptor was defined in 1987 in that AJCC and really hasn't changed since then, as far as the N1, N2, N3 descriptors for lung cancer. And it's faced criticism recently in the last couple editions of the AJCC for not accounting for metastatic disease burden, which is a known prognostic factor. There's also been some talk about the significance of quote unquote skip metastasis, where you find N2 disease with no N1 disease, and the potential implications of that. So a new end staging system has recently been proposed by the IASLC for the ninth edition. And so the cohort was essentially used to validate that end descriptor. So let me see if I can show you. So this is kind of what they did. So this is a retrospective analysis of patients who underwent curative surgery for non-small cell lung cancer between 2004 and 2019. And then the end descriptor was just reclassified according to what is predicted for the ninth edition. So this initial proposal, let me see if I can find this for you because it Took me a minute to wrap my brain around. Where was that? Definition of variables. Okay, so here is the summary of what was proposed and what was finally accepted. So actually the proposal in the IASLC publication, they say it's simple, but it actually is kind of complicated. And they ended up simplifying it for the ninth edition. So the initial proposal included dividing N1 into single station and multi-station N1 disease, which would be N1A and N1B. And then they actually suggested subdividing N2 into three categories. So either single station N2 metastasis without N1 metastasis. So that would be the skip metastasis setting, which was N2A1. A single station N2 metastasis with N1 metastasis, which was N2A2, and then N2B, which was ipsilateral multi-station N2 nodal disease. But I think they thought that was too complicated. So the system that was actually sounds like it's being accepted for the ninth edition includes leaving N0 and N1 and N3 alone and just subdividing N2 disease into single station N2 disease, which will be N2A, and multi-station N2 disease, which is N2B. So a lot more simple, I think, and straightforward than what was originally proposed. So this is a big cohort. This was 6,649 patients. Median follow-up was 54 months. I just wanted to highlight again that this figure. So the patients that were, oops, excluded, included those with N3 disease, those with M1 disease, those with less than six lymph nodes sampled, or those with multifocal lung cancer, so more than one primary lung tumor, in addition to, small cell carcinoma, other concurrent malignancies, et cetera. So those were kind of their exclusion criteria. So when you look, I'm going to kind of focus on the pathologic classification, but they looked at the clinical end stage data as well. So when they looked at the pathologic end stage using the proposed ninth edition criteria, about 75% of patients were N0, and about 11% were N1, 8.5% were N2A, so single station N2, and then about 6% were N2B, so multi-station N2. And then they just plotted their Kaplan-Meier curves. And they did see significant, this is the clinical. Yeah, this is the clinical one. Here's the pathological one. So they did see significant prognostic separation between all adjacent N categories from both a clinical staging standpoint and a pathologic staging standpoint. This is the pathologic staging data here. Overall in progression-free survival, they do see pretty nice separation of those single-station N2 and multi-station N2 patients. This is the curves that when they use that initial proposal where they have N1A, N1B, N2A1, 2A2, and 2B. And again, you see good separation, although we start to get a little mixy here with our curves. So the simplified the version, I think, looks good to me. That sounds easier to keep track of, although I'm sure we would learn it quickly. So essentially, this study validates the clinical utility of the ninth edition's N classification for both clinical and pathologic staging in non-small cell lung cancer and shows clear prognostic separation between the new categories. So I think we should expect the N2 stage to be divided according to whether there is single stage or multi-station and two disease in the upcoming AJCC staging classification. Any comments or questions?
So just curious, so this will be our staging, but how about their clinical stage, like stage 1, 2, 3, A, B, those kinds? Do they have a correlate table to translate that?
I didn't see a correlating table to like final clinical stage. They just have this clinical end stage table here. So I didn't see the correlation table to final clinical stage.
I see.
Maybe I missed it.
Because the table will translate to how they treat, right? So
Yep, I don't know how that's going to shake down. All right. So, I thought I should include a non-neoplastic article for our non-neoplastic aficionados since I have been talking about lung cancer and other poorly differentiated carcinomas for the last half an hour. So, I thought this one was interesting, although I think in the end, probably the results are not unexpected. But this is an autopsy study of lung findings of patients treated with ECMO, which of course is becoming more common that we see patients that are undergoing treatment with either VV or VA ECMO. And the data that exists, it sounds like it's mostly in pediatric autopsy series. So not a lot of data out there regarding adult findings in the lung in patients that undergo ECMO. So this is a series out of a group in Poland, an autopsy series. So just some background. Of course, ECMO is life-saving intervention for those with either severe respiratory or cardiac failure. And the ECMO technology has come really a long way since it was first invented, and that has led to really improved outcomes. However, it's still a very risky procedure, and the risk of life-threatening complications is still quite significant. So prolonged ECMO is pretty much always associated with persistent vasoplegia and coagulopathy, but there are other complications, obviously, as well. So despite this growing use, there's not a lot of data, as I mentioned, on the changes in the lungs that we tend to see with ECMO patients. And another big problem, of course, is that the histologic findings that we're going to see are confounded, particularly in VV ECMO patients. So those patients that the primary problem is in the lungs, almost all those patients clinically have ARDS. So we know we're going to probably see diffuse alveolar damage or other changes of acute lung injury secondary to whatever happened to their lungs that required them to need ECMO in the first place. But we also have the other category of ECMO, the VA ECMO, generally done for cardiac indications, where generally they may be shocky, but they don't necessarily have a primary problem, oxygenation. It's generally pump failure. They basically aim to evaluate the pulmonary histologic findings in the patients who underwent VV ECMO for pulmonary reasons or VA ECMO for cardiac indications shortly before death and subsequently died and underwent an autopsy. So it's a retrospective study of lung auto of autopsies that included lung sampling and ECMO patients. So that they had 83 patients. So 65 had VA ECMO and 18 had VV ECMO. So they compared it to a cohort of 18 patients who did not have ECMO but did have clinical ARDS, thought to likely be due clinically to pneumonia. So they were treated between 2008 and 2020 at a specialty center for heart diseases in Poland. And the autopsy included histopathological examination of lung tissue that they described as sampling from each lobe and any areas of gross abnormality. So pretty similar, I think, to what we do. And then they stained those with H&E and trichrome, reviewed by two blinded pathologists, and then they just collected the clinical data from the medical records. So there was a propensity for male gender, so or male sex, 57 men. The median age was 57 years. So the indications for VA ECMO, so those would be cardiac indications, included cardiomyopathy, either dilated or hypertrophic, acute coronary syndrome, pulmonary embolism with subsequent heart failure, myocarditis, or they needed ECMO post-surgically because they had heart failure post-surgery. So surgeries included transplant, valve replacements, and coronary artery bypass grafting. The VV ECMO patients, so the patients who were on ECMO for a pulmonary indication, 14 of the 18 had clinical ARDS from a variety of etiologies, including pneumonia, sepsis, shock, or influenza. And the remaining four needed VV ECMO after their lung transplant. So they all had lung transplant for pulmonary fibrosis, and then they needed ECMO post-transplant, ECMO support post-transplant. So, Let's go to figure one here. So probably not super surprising here. So here, the top is VA ECMO versus VV ECMO, and the various histopathologic findings that they noted that were most common. And down here is VV ECMO versus those non-ECMO ARDS patients. So the most common histopathologic findings were bronchopneumonia, which was present in over half, interstitial edema, which was 48.2%, although they didn't really describe how they defined that. There are no pictures of that. I mean, I guess edema is edema, but it does seem a little bit of a subjective finding to me. So I'm not exactly sure how they defined that one. And then diffuse alveolar damage, which was present in 38.6% of the ECMO patients. It was more commonly seen in the VV ECMO patients than the VA ECMO patients, as you might expect, with a significant p value of 0.03. But we'll talk about the fact that it was present in VA ECMO patients in quite a high percentage as well. So hemorrhagic infarct with recent organizing thromboemboli was also pretty common, so seen in about a third of patients, and pulmonary hemorrhage was seen in about 30%. So as far as the finding of DAD with hyaline membranes and organization, it was associated with VV ECMO. It was associated with longer ECMO treatment, and it was associated with a longer hospital stay. However, when they put those variables into a multivariate analysis, only the need for VV ECMO was significantly associated with the presence of DAD on autopsy. However, DAD was also present in a significant number of VA ECMO patients, so those undergoing ECMO for cardiac etiology. So that was 32.3%. So still a pretty good number of those patients had DAD at the time of autopsy. The non-ECMO patient control group, they said, had a higher score for interstitial edema and a lower prevalence of bronchopneumonia compared to the ECMO patients, the VV ECMO patients specifically. And then it was a little skimpy, I think, on like actual histological pictures. The only picture they showed, a figure that they showed, was this one where they show pretty clear-cut hyaline membranes with diffuse alveolar damage and then an infar hemorrhagic infarction. So they concluded that somewhat not surprisingly, DAD is common in patients who under rece who are have received ECMO, including both VV ECMO and VA ECMO, and it's a very common finding at the time of autopsy. But there are other findings that are very common as well, including acute pneumonia and infarctions. VV ECMO patients are going to have more DAD. However, you're going to see it in all, up to one third of VA ECMO patients as well. So they suggest that protective lung ventilation is needed in those patients that are undergoing VA ECMO because they seem to be, undergoing some lung injury during their ECMO therapy, even though presumably their lungs were relatively normal at the initiation of ECMO therapy. They noted that pulmonary hemorrhage was more prominent in women and had a short and with a shorter direct duration of ECMO. So they propose that that may be due to whatever underlying etiology required the ECMO in the first place, rather than the ECMO process itself. So in summary, those are kind of the most common findings that they saw in ECMO patients. Probably not surprising, but I think they are nicely documented. Of course, the biggest limitation here is that all of these patients died. So how we can extrapolate this to patients who have to go on ECMO support and make it through is not clear. It is what it is, and at least we have some data now on what is usually observed in these patients. So, any questions or comments, discussions on that one?
I'm curious
This
if they
seems.
mentioned. Sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
No, I'm just gonna say, did they mention correlation with any like radiology data in the literature? So I
Nope.
imagine, if a patient has DAD, you're going to see that on imaging, and these patients are certainly going to be receiving imaging. So,
Yeah,
just
there
from a
was
clinical standpoint, I'd be curious about that.
nope, there was no radiology whatsoever. And it actually is surprising to me that if the main indication for VV ECMO was clinical ARDS, it was surprising to me that actually not 100% of them had DAD, and that was not true. So, there were apparently non-DAD patients clinically presenting as ARDS who had pneumonia or pulmonary edema or other reasons for requiring the VV ECMO because they didn't have DAD at the time of autopsy, which I thought was surprising. Does feel
I
like
was
maybe a
wondering,
sampling
was
thing.
the duration of the ECMO was like a factor at all?
Yeah, so the rate of DAD was increased with the longer the duration of ECMO.
Regardless of the VV versus VA.
I don't remember. I'll have to look back and see. I don't remember if that was one of their subgroup analysis or if that was the whole group. No, that was the whole group, but it wasn't significant in multivariate analysis. So in the whole group, the duration of ECMO correlated DAD, as did VV type of ECMO, but when they put it through multivariate analysis, the duration of ECMO fell off and was no longer significant.
This is Jeff. I guess a couple of comments. One, I don't remember the details of the paper that I think you, Joanne, and Anya were on in CHEST, like around 2018, 2019. And this seems like there's nothing new here compared to what you already reported. Is that more or less true?
Yeah, I guess so. It's very hard because such a mixed bag,
Yeah.
the all kinds of things. It's hard to pull out what is real and what is kind of, who knows what kind of a
Yeah.
underlying disease versus duration versus,
Right.
what have you. So it's a very messy things to analyze, I think. Yeah,
Well,
but I
you're
agree,
good at that.
nothing probably new. I cannot tell anything. I see anything
The other
novel.
comment I would make is, we always talk about DAD and ARDS being roughly equivalent, but they're really not. If you use the physiologic definition of ARDS, a substantial number of those patients just have acute bronchopneumonia. They don't have DAD. So, while almost every patient with DAD in a lung biopsy has ARDS, not every patient with ARDS has DAD.
Great comments. Any other comments or questions in the last minute?
Jen, I had a quick question about one of the notation articles about
Okay.
this NUT-M1 rearranged sarcoma and how the heck we figure that out from a NUT carcinoma, if you had any special insights.
I don't. I think it's
Okay.
really muddy. I think it's really muddy right now. If you don't have keratin expression and or classic morphology for NUT carcinoma, I think it gets difficult to know what to do with those cases, especially because like the line between something looking small round blue cell and something looking kind of epithelioid is not always so clear cut. If it's spindly, I think you have a good indication that you're probably dealing with a sarcoma. And I mean, I remember a case I saw years ago that we didn't have any other group besides NUT carcinoma, but the thing looked spindly, and we ended up calling it NUT carcinoma because it had a NUT rearrangement and it was in an okay location. But clearly, I felt uncomfortable at that time. I'm like, it certainly doesn't look like a carcinoma, but we kind of forced it in there. So I think there will be some cases that are straightforward, but I think this middle ground is going to need to be sorted out, probably with pretty extensive molecular data to see, does this specific fusion partner always mean, always fall in this category or always fall in this category? And I could envision, them being sorted essentially by their fusion partners in the future, because it may have more to do. Because there is some indication that some of those sarcomas probably have a better prognosis than NUT carcinoma, which is almost uniformly very, very aggressive. So it may have some prognostic significance, but I, for those cases kind of in the middle, I don't have a good answer. Ying Chun, anything to add there?
Yeah, I totally agree. We got like criticized it during preparation and review about those, like how do we differentiate those between sarcoma? But I think until there's a prognostic or even treatment indication, say they are different or the same, then we would know better like how to deal with them.
Thank you.
Right. Thanks, everyone, for
Appreciate
great discussion today.
Great Journal Club. Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Yes.
See you. Good
Thank
day.
you.
You too.
Bye, everyone. Thank you so much.